The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, ever thought about wanting to change the shape of your head? Well, peoples in Latin America did thousands of years ago. This practice is called head binding and was done on newborns, when their heads are pliable, to have the desired form of being flat, round, or cone-shaped. We learn all about head binding and the cultural significance of it all. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Parents have been shaping our minds since ancient times, figuratively and literally. Headbinding is a practice that is believed to have originated as early as 13,000 years ago in Australia by Homo sapiens. Some scholars argue as far back as 45,000 years ago. Headbinding has been documented on every continent except Antarctica, so it was a practice that was widely adopted by many peoples throughout history. In the region that is now known as modern-day Peru, peoples desired their heads to be elongated. This particular shape dominated the valley they lived in. They believed that the cranial modifications to their heads would mimic the silhouettes of mountains that were sacred in their culture. I spoke with Matthew Velasco, an associate professor of anthropology at Cornell University, to learn more.
Headbinding is a unique practice because it's seemingly found throughout the world, North and South America, Africa, Europe, Asia, and Australia. There is no one single origin for this practice. I would argue it's a distinctly human practice that we have evidence for the practice over 10,000 years ago, maybe as far back as 20,000 years ago, before sedentary, quote-unquote, civilized societies, and so among hunter-gatherer groups, potentially in areas such as ancient Iran, China, Australia. And so this has a very wide distribution, unlike, let's say, with ceramics are also invented by humans. At a very particular point, we can trace the kind of origin of ceramic production, of pottery production in different points of the world. It's much harder to locate when exactly this technology arises because it is such an ubiquitous and widely distributed practice.
So just what exactly is headbinding and how was it achieved in ancient times? Meaning, what were they doing to shape their heads that way, either the processes or the machines maybe that they used?
Yes. So headbinding involves the application of some kind of apparatus or bandages to the skull to either elongate it or compress it in different dimensions. There's a book by a professor at the University of Northern Iowa, Dr. Tyler O'Brien. The book is called Boards and Cords, and that's kind of a really nice summary of the different types of techniques that can be used, right? So we can place wooden boards on the front and the back of the head and bandage them in such a way that would compress the head from front to back and lead to the expansion of your parietal bones or the parts of your brain case that are above the temples. So kind of a bulging head look. We can also wrap the head circumferentially, so around the head, like in a ring type pattern. And that can lead to constriction and actually funnel the skull in such a way that it grows into an elongated shape, or what, you know, my friends, my colloquially term cone heads, right? So those are kind of the two general shapes that we see, something more compressed and bulging and something more elongated. But depending on where exactly you apply the bandages or the apparatus and the intensity with which you apply those bandages and for the duration of their application, you can get a variety of head shapes in terms of the degree to which they appear elongated. There are only so many ways to modify a skull. Like, there are no cultures that had cube-shaped heads, right? We are somewhat limited by our physiology, but within this overall practice, I suspect there are a variety of techniques across different world regions, within different regions, and that's been a source of investigation for biological anthropologists such as myself.
Was there a one desired look, or was it depending on different cultures and different people? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what would those results look like? Kind of go a little bit deeper into that.
I think that there is no one desired look. It's culturally variable. Just as a quick anecdote, in the region I study, there are two groups in Highland Peru in the Colca Valley area, and we learn about their head-shaping practices in a Spanish colonial document. And they describe one group having the elongated form and another having the more squat and wide form, and they actually refer to that form as ugly in the text, but not the elongated form. So in that way, I get a sense that even in the past, right, there are certain biases or ways that people might perceive a head shape that is not theirs as ugly, right? But of course, for the people who practiced it, it was likely beautiful. And so, you know, in a sense, the answer is variable because the desired look or what is beautiful to different people and to different cultures changes, right? Even today, like the ideal bodily form that we might see represented in magazines or in certain public venues is not necessarily shared globally or even within our own American society, right? There's different attitudes towards body type and beauty. And so we shouldn't expect that there would be one head shape in the past. We could delve deep into any one region. And I gave you one example from the Andes, which I'll certainly talk more about today. But in the Maya region, many cultures have elongated heads. But in the Maya region, we see a similarity between the elongated head shape and the form of the head of the maize god, as depicted on vase paintings. So there may have been, and the maize god, I should say, is in Maya cultures seen as a paragon of beauty. And so while one society might see the elongated head as taking the form of a mountain, which is the case with the peoples I studied in ancient Peru, for the Maya, it may have taken the form of a corn cob. And neither, you know, well, certainly people might find beauty in corn today or beauty in the landscape, but, you know, that may not be the exact kind of way we would anchor or compare our bodies or how we would understand our bodies today. So you really have to think about the body from different cultural perspectives to understand how people in the past may have perceived their heads as moldable and as artifacts of beauty ideals.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. If you're just joining us, we're learning all about headbinding that took place in the region of Peru 13,000 years ago with Matthew Velasco, an associate professor of anthropology at Cornell University.
The peoples that you looked at were primarily in the Peruvian region in Latin America. So I'm wondering, the headbinding that they did, you've kind of touched on this a little bit previously. Was there a cultural significance behind that practice?
Absolutely. What's unique about the peoples I studied, so I studied human skeletal remains that date to about the 14th and 15th century, the 1300s, 1400s. And these people, we can have reason, good reason to believe, are the ancestors of 16th century descendants who tell the Spanish colonial administrators why they reshaped their heads. We don't have a lot of cases where we have testimony from indigenous people in the Americas saying why we do it. And in this region, they say, we shape the heads of our children in the form of the mountains from which we came. It's worth unpacking that for a second, right? Because on one hand, saying, you know, we shape our heads in the form of a mountain could be a metaphor, right? The invoking the majesty and beauty of a mountain. And certainly there is a dimension to that. But it is also something more intimate and profound about the origin of these people who quite literally claimed that they sprang forth from a mountain. And they emerged from this volcano and then entered into the valley where they ultimately inhabited, lived, and died. And so in a way, they're remembering that origin story in the heads of their infants. So there's this really kind of intimacy between the origin of the people and like the birth of a new child that is invoked through this practice. Now, this is something they say, I think it's 1586, to a Spanish colonial administrator. Can I say that ancient people in the Andes in the 1300s and 1400s felt the exact same way about their heads? No, but it does remind us that when we think about head shaping, we have to ask, what are the kind of proximate cultural motivations. Like, why do people do it, right? There's one thing to say, well, you know, as anthropologists, we think this indicated group differentiation during a time of much warfare, which is something people have said in the Andes. But for people who practiced it, like, what motivated them to do it? What did it mean to them? What were the consequences for children growing up with the head in the form of a mountain? My work really is trying to think more on the specific cultural terms of the practice and taking the testimonies of indigenous elites from the 16th century, taking them seriously, and then really unpacking what are the different meanings that Andean peoples attach to mountains, even in kind of more recent ethnographic accounts of living peoples in the Andes, we see other associations between kind of the wild power of a mountain and the untamed quality of a child. Like, children are thought of as sort of wild entities that need to be tamed. And so while I don't look at my child and think of a mountain, I think that people in the Andes may have seen a similarity beyond simply the form of the head or the form of the mountain, but also the qualities that those beings possess, because mountains in Andean societies are thought of as sentient, powerful beings that have influence over human society, not merely inert backdrops to human behavior and society.
So in your book, The Mountain Embodied, you push this narrative that headbinding is not just an ethnic marker, right? That was largely a colonial invention, primarily that practice was a ethnic marker. So can you explain why you don't believe that?
Yes, thank you for bringing up this question. It's sometimes hard to kind of convey my argument. It takes a long time to develop in the course of the book. But what I want to really emphasize is that, yes, head shape can be ethnic, right? The clothes we wear today can be ethnically marked, right? Someone from a different country might see the way I dress or the way I conduct myself as ethnically American, right? I might be stereotyped as distinctly American for the way I talk, the way I dress, right? The way I carry myself. We could say this about people in the past, the way they dress, the way they express their identities through their bodies. And so any practice or behavior can be thought of as ethnic. What I am trying to say is we shouldn't think about these practices as simply ethnic and leave the analysis there, right? So we see a modified head, or maybe you saw some images of modified heads preparing for this interview, and it's a little weird, right? It's different. It could be unsettling to people, no doubt. We see it as something other people do. The Inca and the Spanish also likely saw it as something the people that they conquered did, right? Not something they did, it's other people, right? Group A modifies their head in this way, group B modifies their head in another way. And for the Inca and the Spanish, which were both empires in their own right, it becomes a way to categorize people and perhaps even stereotype them. And stereotypes, right, can sometimes be harmful. Sometimes they're a shorthand for people in a certain region do this certain thing, right? But it's a pretty superficial way to understand human diversity, right? We could take any region of this country and we have stereotypes of the South, stereotypes of the Northeast, stereotypes of California. But if that was it, if that was where we left our understanding of those regions of the world, anyone who grew up in the South or the Northeast or California can speak to remarkable diversity and subtleties in cultural practices, forms of cultural hybridity, practices that have been adopted from other cultures into another. Human society is so complex. And so the goal of my book is to say, like, sure, this head shape for the Koyawas people of the Colca Valley that I studied may have indicated their ethnicity to others. But what did it mean to them? And why is it that some people in this society, in this ethnic group, didn't modify their heads? Were they less ethnic than the other person? Like, no one can be less ethnic, right? Everyone is ethnic from the point of view of someone else. And so part of the goal is to shift from that outsider's perspective on this practice that other people perform and ask, what did the practice mean for the people who were doing it?
In 2018, you did a study where you went to two Koyawa cemeteries to examine skulls of 213 mummified humans. What did you find? Did anything surprise you? And what was that experience like?
It was incredible. It's an incredible privilege to be afforded not only the permission to work perform archaeological research in another country, but the trust of community members in the region to study remains of their ancestors, to study their cultural patrimony. There's so much I could say about the experience. I'm almost overwhelmed recalling it. I will say that it was very much a journey of discovery. This site, the sites I studied, are above ground buildings for the dead, right? They are apartment buildings where mummified individuals would have been placed. In the Andes, we sometimes refer to these tombs as, quote, tombs for the living. And what we mean by that is that although the bodies placed in them were biologically dead, they were still very active participants in society. They were probably brought out for certain ceremonies. Offerings were made to the ancestors for good harvests, for good fortune, and so on. And so the dead were a very active part of the lives of the living. When I encountered these tombs, right, there are very few mummified individuals left, right? Most of the mummy bundles, these ancestors would have been wrapped in textiles and placed in a kind of cocoon-like encasing made of grass. These cocoons had been ripped asunder. There had been a lot of looting and loss of objects with which the dead were buried. And yet the human skeletal remains themselves afforded a pathway toward reconstructing society and understanding people's lives in the past. I came into the project with a lot of preconceived ideas about what I was going to study, and my focus was not head shaping at the time. Head shaping became kind of the key to understanding the site. And so I'll give one example of that. These are apartment buildings for the dead. There, you can imagine these above ground chambers built one against another. And so when you first encounter the site, it's almost like a multi-storied building. But actually, the more time we spent at the site, we could see that these tombs were built one against another across time, and we could start to piece together an architectural sequence. We did radiocarbon dating. We learned that the site was used over 4 centuries. Then we studied the human remains at the site, and it turns out that those buried in the earliest tombs, right, the tombs that were built first in the architectural sequence, mostly, if not exclusively, have unmodified heads, and those later, in the later tombs, have modified heads. And so I was like, what's up with that? Are these a new group that came into the region and took over this practice? And, to make a long story short, no. I think these are the descendants of the round head people who transform their way of expressing an identity. We've since done some DNA analyses that will be published probably within the next year, showing that modified individuals and those with round heads are closely related to one another. This isn't a conquering group that invaded the region, this conquering group with elongated heads that displaced the round-headed people. No, these are groups that are closely related to one another, probably saw themselves as part of the same ancestral lineage, and yet not all have this purportedly ethnic marker. And so that discovery was really what launches the subsequent phases of my research, trying to understand why is it that families might have modified heads and unmodified heads? Like, how do we make sense of that variation? And it wasn't apparent when I started the project. And so much of archaeology is like that. You go in, with one particular research agenda, and you end up making a discovery that upends your assumptions, and then spending, well, quite frankly, over 10 years trying to understand why it is you found what you did.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. I've been speaking with Matthew Velasco, an associate professor of anthropology at Cornell University, all about headbinding to learn more.
Also, in your book, you argue that headbinding caused social disparity. So I'm wondering, what are those social disparities and the reasoning behind that?
Yeah, that's another point that I kind of want to nuance, because I've, the first time I published my research in the kind of initial study in 2018, a lot of the press coverage was that head shaping is a practice that marked elites, that it was something for higher status individuals. And I don't actually know that, right? What I cannot claim that only elite individuals modified their heads, simply because we haven't studied what lower status individuals in the valley. We haven't found their tombs. We haven't studied what their head shaping practices might have been. But it does seem like head shaping is somehow intertwined with the generation of social disparities and inequality in this region. And I'll walk you through my logic here, right? There's no one smoking gun. It's really the confluence of multiple pieces of evidence. So we know in the colonial period in this region of Peru, there are stark differences in land and livestock wealth, right? There are certain extended families that are much wealthier than others. One of the big surprises of my study of modified individuals, again, who are living 200 years before the colonial period, is that modified individuals actually show a lot of variety in their diets and where they were born. And we can determine where individuals spent their childhood and what kind of foods they ate, both as children and adults, through chemical analysis of bones and teeth. So we have really good scientific evidence for this. And modified people as a group, they don't all eat the same foods. Some seem to be growing up in higher altitude regions where they don't grow corn. Others seem to be eating a lot more corn, which suggests they're in lower altitude valleys, right? And so I suspect that modified individuals had access to a wider range of lands and resources. And so that's one line of evidence, right? I know that there's inequality in the colonial period. I know that modified individuals have this greater dietary diversity or maybe a wider range of access to resources. And then I think about this practice of head binding and reading Andean ethnographies, so accounts of modern and historic peoples in the Andes. Childhood ceremonies are actually a really important rite of passage where children may be granted lands and herds when they are kids by their godparents, by their parents. So it got me to thinking that maybe head binding is not only a practice performed on the body, but it is also a certain rite of passage that involves the attribution of a certain social role to an individual, if not specific conferral of resources and goods, right? So I don't have a smoking gun here, but I do see that modified individuals have unique livelihoods and that this is tied to resource access. And I know how the story ends in the colonial period. And what I argue in the book is that binding the head of the infant could have been a pathway toward wealth generation, toward the maintenance of wealth within families, right? So let's say the firstborn, you confer certain lands in a certain region to them, and they grow up and they move to that region and they take care of those resources and they grow into certain wealth that maybe other children do not have access to in society. One final line of evidence is that children, girls specifically who are modified, have their heads modified, later in life they show lower rates of cranial trauma. This is a time in Peru where there's a lot of violence, high rates of violence, evidence of warfare in fortified sites and so forth. But modified women in particularly show the lowest rate of violence. So it suggests to me that there is some sort of social benefit to being modified, some sort of privilege associated, and yet it's not a question of haves or have-nots, because modified people are also buried alongside individuals with round heads, but they may have held a higher rank within their families and had preferential access to certain resources that then could be leveraged into political power. It's a bit of a detective work where I have all these pieces of evidence about resource access and health outcomes related to exposure to violence. And I kind of know what things are like in the colonial period, and I have evidence on the pre-Inca and pre-colonial period. And I'm trying to weave together this evidence to tell a story of how head shaping may have been brought into this process that ultimately generates economic inequality.
So I want to know, what is the most fascinating thing or surprising aspect of all this research, head binding? Like, what fascinates you the most about it?
I think what fascinates me the most about it is the tension between something that is so exotic and sensationalized in the press, in our current understandings of, or in popular conceptions of the practice today. And yet, in the past, I would argue it was very normal and intimate, almost mundane. We're so obsessed with the shape of the skull, but I remind my students that no one is actually shaping the skull. They're shaping a head, and heads have hairstyles, and they might also have hats and different headdresses. And so, you know, how much it actually mattered that the head was elongated to people, I've given examples where I think it did matter. I sometimes think it, what was more important was the practice of wrapping and caring for a child and not necessarily the outcome. So what's really most fascinating to me is how mundane it might have been, right? How normal something that we, something we find so peculiar might have been totally normal in a different time and place. And it's a reminder of how malleable the human body can be and how culturally variable we are, right? We really take for granted certain aspects of our lives and what we consider normal. But, you know, from the perspective of someone in 14th century Peru, I think our lives would look pretty weird in certain ways that we are not always cognizant of. And so that's what's really kind of fascinating to me, is that tension between familiar and the strange.
What are you looking forward to researching further into in this topic, or is there a new research that you're exploring?
Yeah, my book really focuses on one group in the Colca Valley of Highland Peru. And the next phase of my research is going to branch out to other sites and hopefully segments of society to more fully understand social diversity in relation to head shaping. I mentioned earlier in our conversation about these ideas I have about resource access and access to different lands and perhaps livestock and how that might have been tied to head shaping. And so a lot of my research thus far has pointed me to some indirect evidence of economic transformations. And I'm really interested in better understanding resource access and subsistence adaptations in the Colca Valley. Because what I've not mentioned is that the time periods that I study are also a time of very intense warfare, I did mention that, but also of climate instability. So this is a time where societies are kind of reconfiguring how they raise their herds, how they grow their crops. And so I am really interested in linking up the patterns I see in head shaping and in the skeletal evidence with broader scale evidence about cultivation, farming, and herding in the past. And to do that, I can't do it alone. So the next phase of my research is in collaboration with Professor Brianna Langley from Binghamton University and Professor Lauren Cohut from Winthrop University. And we are really kind of assembling a team of people with different skills in the analysis of plant remains, ancient landscapes, animal remains, to get a really broad view of society and subsistence in this region of the world and better understand the conditions under which inequality is generated.
That was Matthew Velasco, an associate professor of anthropology at Cornell University. His research was originally published in his book, The Mountain Embodied. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1828. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Madeline Reynolds.